morning. Good morning. I had thought the people here were going to bring samples, so I left my phone. Our topic for this morning is charoset. Charoset. Thank you. But actually, before we get to that, I wanted to teach something. And by the way, the fault with the blackboard was mine. I forgot to ask for one, so I can take credit for that. But we will need it. But first, before we get to the charoset, before we get to the blackboard, I wanted to teach something which I learned from a woman in the community where I lived before coming to Toronto. And it's called Seder Aerobics. Anyone ever hear of this? Well, she has, thank God, quite a few children and grandchildren. And she is the consummate teacher. She was a day school principal. She taught for many, many years. And she noticed that at certain points during the Seder, people have difficulty sometimes focusing. And you know, people start to fade away out of what's going on. And so I think this was her own device. It was called Seder Aerobics. The way it works, I brought you the picture at the top of your sheet so you can visualize the ka'ara, the Seder plate. I didn't choose one with English words. I probably should have made life easier. But the way it works is you have different parts of the Seder plate. Now, there are a couple of different customs, but I chose one. So if you imagine for yourself, if you visualize for yourself the Seder plate like this, and then you have up here the egg, and up here it has chazeret, which I'm going to write that just to fit it in, and then here you have the shank bone, and then over here they put the carapace. And again, there are different ways to do it. I wouldn't get hung up on that. The point is this. She has everybody stand up. Not now here, but she has everybody in the Seder stand up. And literally, Seder aerobics. So she tells them, egg, and they all have to go like this. And then chazeret, and they go like that. And so on for the different parts of the Seder. The kids love it. It helps them learn what's on the different parts of the Seder plate. Refreshes everybody for a couple of minutes, and then they go back in. And so just at some point during the Seder, she'll say, Seder aerobics, and then that's what they all do for the next few minutes, and they go back to it. And it works. It was very funny because in my community where I lived, in Allentown, we had a model Seder one year before Passover, a chance to sort of go through the Seder, have Torah thoughts and explanations and so forth. And the local paper, the Allentown Morning Call, came to cover the program. And we thought we had a pretty good program. We had different wines for a wine tasting part of it. We thought it was a good, solid program. The big picture in the paper the next day was the Seder aerobics picture. That was what they chose for their headline. But definitely recommend it. It does work. Okay. Main topic is charoset. What's the best recipe for charoset? I brought you a Martha Stewart one just because I couldn't. I couldn't do this without bringing you a recipe. Apples, pecans, wine. You know there's a lot better wine than Manischewitz out there, right? Seriously? Sugar, cinnamon. Sorry? So here you have pecans, which I thought was interesting. Walnuts people have.
Honey?
Some people put honey in it?
Okay. I do.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. When you talk about what you use, and we have ingredients here and people have offered others, what are you looking for when you choose your ingredients? What's your goal? Sweet. Sorry?
Fresh.
I don't mean when you choose which ingredient to use, but when you put together your recipe, you're going for a certain result.
Yeah, I want how thick.
Thick. Sorry?
Sticky.
Feeling like mortar, right. So we have sweet. We have mortar. The question is whether that was intentional. What else? Make a lot of it, okay. Crunchy. Crunchy, okay. What else? Yeah. Spicy. Not really spicy exactly. You say ginger, but like tart, right? Yeah.
Cinnamon.
What's your goal with the cinnamon? Look like mortar? Okay. The color. What color do you want? Brown. Beige. Beige harosa. That's like a Martha Stewart. It's getting beige. Okay. So, we do have, in fact, an emphasis on the taste. We have an emphasis on the texture, and we have an emphasis on the color. All of those actually are relevant. But in order to understand what we're going for when we have haroses, we need to first understand why we use haroses in the first place. And it may not surprise you to know that there are several reasons for why we use haroses. All of these reasons are literally millennia old. So there's a lot to know when it comes to the humble haroses. So the first general point that I would make about the Seder is I think of the Seder as ballet, you know, with or without the aerobics piece of it. But really, I think of the Seder as educational ballet in the sense that ballet is meant to convey a message. There's a story. In all the different actions of the dancers, they're trying to convey something to everybody else there, to the audience. And ballet can be performed by a 5-year-old at a recital, or it can be performed by, you know, experts, people who are skilled and so on. And it will have as much meaning as the performer puts into it. What elements of the Seder do you see that have that kind of ballet image to them? What do we do with the Seder that supports this? Sorry? Sorry?
Tell a story.
Group participation, telling a story. But what actions at the Seder? Picking up the Seder plate at certain points. What else? I don't think they let you eat at the ballet. Yeah. Picking up the cup. Right.
You know, where you like dip and.
Right, dipping.
Yeah.
Right, where you, not just dipping the food, but dipping your finger in and taking out the drops. That's part of it also. You cover the matzah, you uncover the matzah. Breaking the middle matzah. Right? Reclining, hiding the avikomen.
Opening the door.
Opening the door. For Eliyah, correct. Well, there are actually multiple reasons why we open the door, some of which don't involve Eliyahu at all. The origin of opening the door at the Seder is likely because the Torah calls the Seder night the night of protection. And so you opened your door actually for the duration of the Seder originally to demonstrate I'm not afraid of anything. The problem is that over the centuries we became afraid of everything. And so therefore what we decided to do was we're going to leave the door closed except at the end once everybody out there is asleep. Then we'll open the door a little bit to show that we're not afraid. It has a lot to do with Pesach being at Easter time and some of the dangers that were associated with it. But it is meant to be a form of ballet, a dance, something we are meant to act out and interpret. You know, one of my favorite examples of this is the act of leaning. What's the goal of leaning at the Seder? Demonstrating that you're royalty, right? There's a sense of freedom. There's a sense that no one controls me. I can slouch if I want. right? That kind of experience. Of course, it's a little hard for us to do, right? Leaving is not so easy. Anyone there we go. Thank you. You can just put it on the table. That would be great. Thank you, Dan. I'll explain what that is in a moment. When it comes to leaning, if you're sitting in chairs like these, it's not so easy, and it's not so comfortable. Well, the falling off, actually, I found a solution for that. You turn your chair sideways, and then you lean against the back. So that's my strategy. But if you can get a couch or an armchair or something like that, then you're leaning properly. But it's the reason why I cite that as an example is because we, as Westerners, are used to folding our bodies at 90-degree angles in order to fit them into chairs. But historically, that wasn't the way that people ate, right? They were on couches, and they were really reclining. That was the way that people ate. So what we're doing now is we are performing an action which is meant to transport us back in time. So we imagine ourselves in that way, even though to us right now, in our lives, bless you, it doesn't really resonate. We're supposed to interpret the action, which for us is very artificial, in order to draw a lesson. Similarly, dipping, the idea of dipping as a sign of wealth. You know, dips are not considered to be anything special in our day. Nonetheless, we're supposed to put ourselves in that frame of mind. The fellow who was just here, who brought something in and left on the table, I'll just explain what that is. I was supposed to bring it and I forgot it, so he brought it. It's called a Seder Companion, my program, the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzion Beit Midrash. So we put out a pamphlet with Torah thoughts related to the Seder, so you can bring it to your Seder and you have something ready-made to say. So they're free, so feel free to take on your way out. Sorry, people can take them afterwards. Yeah. Okay. So when it comes to the Charoset, then, we have to ask ourselves, what is the message that the Charoset is meant to convey? As with all the actions of the Seder and all of the foods of the Seder, what are we supposed to learn from the Charoset? So, I'll ask you, what are the messages of the Charoset?
The bricks.
Bricks? Right, the clay, the mortar, the bricks, right? That speaks to the texture of the charoset and wanting to have the mortar. So then why does it have to be sweet?
For a sweet year.
A sweet year? Different holiday. Taking the pain out of the slavery. So on the one hand, we're going to remind us of the slavery by having clay, but on the other hand, sweet, so that it's a sweeter slavery? Maybe. We have to learn a little bit about this, and that will help us figure out what the recipe should be for haroset. So the first explanation for why there's haroset is terrible. Insecticide. Yeah, what? Really? Did he just say that? So take a look at source number one, please. It's a passage from the Talmud. Describing a person sitting at his Seder. The Talmud says, first it brings us a Mishnah, an early source, followed by the Gemara, the commentary on it. And it says, they bring before him matzah, chazeret, and charoset. Chazeret there, a reference to what we use for maror. And we're going to come back to that in a minute. Charoset and two cooked foods. Today, the two cooked foods people tend to use are? The egg and the shank bone. Right. Historically, it wasn't necessarily that at all in Talmudic times. They had a whole bunch of foods that they used for the two cooked foods. But they say, you bring these items, even though charoset is not a mitzvah. The first view is, there's no mitzvah of having charoset, but they bring it anyway. And Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Tzadok, says, no, it's a mitzvah. To which the sages ask, if it's not a mitzvah, why bring it? Why bring it? Why do you have it at your Seder? To which Rabbi Ami said, because of something called kava. Kava will not be a familiar word. It's an Aramaic term. So the question is, what does kava mean? Well, take a look at source number two, please. Rashi, the classic commentator to the Talmud, says, the sap in chazeret is harsh and contains a toxin. Now, Chazeret, I told you, is maror, right? Is the bitter herb. What do you use for maror?
Horseradish.
Anybody not use horseradish?
Romaine
lettuce, right? Romaine lettuce is popular. So maror is supposed to be a bitter vegetable. When you go back to the times of the Talmud and they were defining your options for maror, they actually said it was supposed to be green, it was supposed to be a leaf, and it was supposed to be bitter tasting. There are a couple of other criteria as well. But it didn't fit horseradish at all. Horseradish is a root, and it's white, gray, brown, whatever. And it's not bitter. Sharp. It's not bitter. So how is it that, 70-80% of the room ended up using horseradish? Well, the answer is that over time, Jews migrated to countries where you couldn't get green leafies at this time of year. Wasn't available. Poland, Germany, places like that, forget it. Not happening. So that what they found was they actually started using horseradish leaf, because the root stays in the ground all year long. And they were using the leaf, which I've grown, and it's actually very good. The leaf of the horseradish fits this very nicely. However, they ran into trouble with that also eventually, just in terms of supply. And they started using the top of the root. If you grow it in such a way that the top protrudes above the ground, so they considered that to be, well, that's sort of like the leaf. Also, there were some other twists and turns along the way. If this were a class on maror, we could talk about it more. But people ended up using horseradish, but it's not the original. It's definitely not the original. The original was a form of lettuce, not exactly romaine, but it was a form of lettuce which had a sap inside of it. And the sap is what Rashi is talking about here, and he says it's very harsh. It contains a toxin. Now, some of these sharp-eyed people here already noted that there's actually, on the Seder plate, there's chazeret and there's maror. I'm not going into that right now, but yes, it's true. They're listed separately there on the Seder plate. So Rashi is calling chazeret, he's referring to what we think of as maror. So the statement that Rashi makes is, you want chazeret as an antidote to something that is actually toxic, that is in maror. That's one explanation. Tosafot, if you take a look at source number 3, two generations after Rashi, offers another explanation. Rabbeinu Hananel explained that this is a worm. Kapha is a worm. There's a worm in the maror. Yeah, what? That's what he said. And then he has a problem. Because if that's true, then it's not kosher. What are you doing with worms in your maror? So he suggests maybe greens in general that they're using don't have this kapha, but because there's a danger, and we're worried about people getting hurt, so alright, so we'll use the charoset, because the charoset is the antidote to this kapha. It's a longer discussion, but the key is that number one, that means this is not a mitzvah charoset, it's there as an antidote either for the toxin, or as an insecticide for this odd worm. But if I'm going to take Rashi's view that it's about this sharp taste that's in the maror that I'm trying to get rid of, or this harsh taste, I should say, that's in the maror that I'm trying to get rid of, then what should my charoset be? Should be sweet, right? If I take Rashi's view. Whereas the view of Tosfot says that you're using this as an insecticide, you actually want to have vinegar. Vinegar is what's in there in order to kill this worm. Boy, things you never expected to learn about your charoset. Anybody here use vinegar in charoset? I've never heard of anybody using vinegar in charoset. Nonetheless, that's what we're going to end up with according to this. So what we have is our first layer. Our first layer is that the reason we're using it is either because of the toxin, that was Rashi's approach, in which case I'm actually looking for something that's going to be sweet. It's not a true toxin in the sense of being poisonous. It's not really what he's getting at. As much as it's a very sharp taste, then it's bad for the system. And then I have another view that says that it's because of this kappa insect, or some kind of insect, worm, whatever it is. And that according to that, what I actually want to have is something with vinegar in it. Something sharp. Go figure. That's not what people usually learn about when they learn about harosa. Yes? Ah, lemon juice. Okay, well, maybe that would fit with the idea that it's for the insect. Maybe what we really want is something acidic. So you'll serve that with lemon juice. Could be. You ever see any kappa worms? Okay. Now we get to something that's a little more conventional. Second approach is that the goal of the charoset is to remember the apple. What apple was there in Egypt? What apple are you talking about? Virginia, you're telling us these strange things about Haroset. What? Garden of Eden? Uh-oh. Wait, back up. The Torah never says that the tree in the Garden of Eden was an apple. Nope. The Torah says it was a fruit. That's all it says. However, we will soon find out why the Christian world decided that it was an apple, something that they then communicated into the Jewish world as well. We're going to get to that. Take a look at source number four. Source number four is from the Talmud. After that initial source that we saw at number one brought the view of Rabbi Eliezer, son of Rabbi Tzadok, who said that charoset is a mitzvah, so they asked, so what mitzvah exactly is charoset? There is no verse in the Torah that says, you know, eat charoset. There's a verse that says eat maror. There's a verse that says eat matzah. Where is there a verse that says eat charoset? So Rabbi Levi said it's to commemorate the apple. And he says make it tart to commemorate the apple. It's not a sweet apple. It's a sharp-tasting apple. So they write, where in the world did this come from? Well, it comes from source number five. Source number five is a verse from Shir HaShirim, from Song of Songs, in which God addresses the Jewish people and he says, beneath the apple I awakened you. There your mother birthed you. There the one who birthed you experienced birth pangs. Beneath the apple tree. You were born, you were delivered underneath the apple tree. Now, the truth is, Egypt did have apple trees at this moment in history. At that time, they had already been imported. They used a name for it, which is like the name in Hebrew. What's the name in Hebrew? Tapuah. So that became the name as well in Egypt, because these were imported trees. They weren't native to Egypt. And that is the source. If you take a look at source number six, we are told about the women in Egypt and how they gave birth. At the time to give birth, they went and gave birth in the field, under the apple, as in Song of Songs. And there, the Talmud discusses miracles that were performed such that the babies could survive the Egyptian decree to kill them. Wait, don't flip the page just yet. Hang on. Because someone mentioned the Garden of Eden, and I would be lax if I didn't explain what that's about. As I said, the tree in the Garden of Eden is not identified as an apple tree, biblically. Where it comes from is a read of number five, and a funny word in number five. The verse goes in Hebrew, Tacharat ha-puach orartich, shama chiblatcha imacha. This is the word for my Hebrew readers. Chiblatcha. Which I translated here as birthed you. Anybody familiar with the phrase Chavlei Leida?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Hard to translate.
It is very hard to translate. But it's birth pangs, right? Birth pangs. And that's how Lacha becomes birthed you. It makes sense. However, what is Lachbol in Hebrew? Right now? What's a mechabel in Hebrew? Mechabel is a terrorist, exactly. Labol is to wound. To wound. And the Christians translate it, Kiblatcha, as wounded or corrupted you. So now, if you read the sentence the way that they read it, there beneath the tree, your mother corrupted you. What's that a reference to? No. Eve, Garden of Eden. She corrupted you. That's the way they took it. Blame the St. Augustine, not me. There, under the tree, your mother corrupted you by eating from the fruit. Original sin, that whole...
Is that why you're born in sin?
Yeah, that's where that comes from. So the church decided that the tree was an apple tree. And that made it into Christian art, which made it, of course, into the Jewish world, because we as a minority are living in their world, and a lot of Jews came to believe that it was an apple tree. Here's another funny thing while we're at it. The word in Hebrew for apple is? Tapuach, correct. So the Torah, when it uses the term tapuach, doesn't say apple, it says tapuach, right? Well, for centuries, until about the 1940s, 1950s, they believed that apples weren't actually there in that part of the world at that time in history. They believed there were no apples. And they argued that tapuach didn't even mean apple. They suggested quince. They suggested citrus fruits. Because the word tapuach itself doesn't mean apple per se. What does it mean in Hebrew? Something that's bloated, basically. Something bloated, B-L-O-A-T-E-D, bloated. For example, what's the word in Hebrew for an orange? Tapuz, which stands for? Tapuach zahav, a golden apple or a golden round and bloated fruit. Blood doesn't sound nice, I need a better word. But what's the word in Hebrew for potato? Tapuach adama. All of these... Right, are from that same root. It's this apple-like shape. I mean, it's also because of French. But the point is that the word tapuach, they say, didn't have to mean apple. It could have been some other round fruit. It didn't have to be the apple at all. But in the 1950s, archaeologists discovered, lo and behold, apple orchards that had been demolished by the Romans. From way back when. And yes, they did have apples at that time, and therefore tapuach is restored to being an apple. But it's a very funny thing when you think about it, because they were taking this verse from Song of Songs, retranslating it, ending up that we're under the apple tree, but in the meantime, historians believe there were no apples there at that time. It's very confusing. In any case, the Talmud actually, Talmud and Midrash offer four different fruits that it could have been in the Garden of Eden, apple ain't one of them. They offer one is the etrog, because the etrog is described in the Talmud as being in the Torah as being a beautiful fruit, and Eve looks at the fruit and sees that it is beautiful. So that's one suggestion. Another suggestion is that it's a grape, because no fruit, as the Talmud says, brings wailing to the world and crying to the world like the grape. So they suggest that maybe it was a grape. Another suggestion that's offered is that it was a fig. Because right after that, they take fig leaves and make them into clothing for themselves. And then the other suggestion is that it's actually not what we would consider a fruit at all, but it's wheat. Because a person, around the age when you start eating grain-based products, that's the age when you start to develop intellect, and this was the tree of knowledge. In any case, apple isn't one of ours in terms of the fruit in the garden, but what it is, going back to Haroset or somewhere near it, The message that we're getting here is that, as the Talmud is saying it, we eat charoset in order to commemorate the apple trees beneath which the women gave birth in Egypt. And then these were associated with miracles God performs in order to save the Jews from the Egyptian decree. Clear? Going back to our recipe then, if what we're trying to do is to commemorate the apple. Erase the word acid by accident. But if we're trying to commemorate the apple, then we should be including apples. Right? Apples are a requirement for the harvested thing. Clear? Straightforward? Good. But there's more. Because a third element of the charoset is the one that I think most people here quoted, which is the clay in Egypt. If you take a look now, you can flip onto the second side. I brought you a couple of verses from Exodus describing the bricks that they worked with and the clay that they had, right? And they embittered their lives with hard labor, with clay and bricks and all manner of field work. And then another verse, after Moses goes to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, I'm not letting them go, just the opposite, I'm going to make things worse for them. Now go work, and straw will not be given to you, and you shall give the quota of bricks. You still have to provide the same quota, but you're going to have to make your own bricks. So this is generally understood. This is generally understood to be about texture rather than taste. It doesn't have to taste like bricks. It just has to have the texture of it. So take a look at number 8. The Talmud says, Rabbi Yochanan said, commemorating the clay. That's what it's for. And he says, make it thick in order to commemorate the clay. As a matter of fact, some suggest that that's the origin of the word charoset itself. Anybody know what the word cheres is? What is cheres? Cheres is pottery. So some suggest that that's the origin of the word charoset is pottery. But more than that, so yes, that's what you're bringing out for people, clay, pottery. But some go further than this and say it's not only that we want it to be thick, but we want to remember the straw that was in the bricks. Take a look at number 9, please. Rabbi Mordechai ben Hillel, writing in 13th century Germany, quotes an earlier work called Rokeach, an early Ashkenazi work. Rokeach wrote that this is why we place in charoset sweet cane. I'm not 100% sure that he means cane, like sugar cane. The word he's translating is kaneh. But it's sweet cane, cinnamon, and ginger. There's your ginger. Why? Because one cannot crush them well to avoid having tough strands. This commemorates the clay which had straw mixed into it. In other words, what he wants are long, thin pieces in the charoset in order to remember the straw. And in fact, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, in source number 10, gives us his charoset recipe. Take a look. This is what they're doing in Egypt in the 12th century. It would be cool, actually, at the Seder to bring a bunch of charoset, you can't really say charosets, but I guess you have to. A bunch of bowls of charoset out with different recipes used for each one. You do that? Okay. So now you can have the Maimonidean charoset. He says, this is an acidic mixture, like straw, commemorating the clay. We make it thus. We soak figs or dates, boiling and crushing them until they soften. We knead them with vinegar and add, and he mentions sanbel and karnit, it's not clear what those are, but then he says hyssop. Hyssop. With that, which is, it's a branch. And he's not putting in a branch, he's putting in little, slivers. Without grinding. I hope they're not eating it. And you can dip in it, but don't eat the hyssop. But the point is, what he emphasizes, not to grind it up. You want to have these pieces in, so they'll be like straw. However, I just said to you that the way we emulate the clay is with the texture, right? Having a thick mixture and possibly having straw-like pieces in it. But there is an element regarding taste as well. Take a look, please, at source number 11, where I go back to Rabbi Mordechai ben Hillel, who quotes the work called the Aruch, which was out of France in the 10th or 11th century. Rabbi Yochanan says that to commemorate the clay, we make charoset of all kinds of food, sweet, bitter, acidic, like clay, which contains everything. In other words, just like with clay that they're working with, they just throw everything in there, so we're going to have a welter of tastes within it, all blending together, just like in clay. So, to put this up on the board now, clay is our third element after the toxin or insect issue, we then add apple. Now we have clay, and that tells us it has to be thick. It should have something like straw in it. It doesn't have to be an edible, just like strands of something. And, in addition, that you want to have a mixture of tastes. Wow. There's an awful lot to this harose that I never would have guessed. And I did it. Before getting into this and reading a couple of articles and doing research on it, I never understood the depth of this, but we aren't done. Because there's another layer to this. We've discussed on other occasions that the Talmud was developed as a response to the problems with transmitting the verbal traditions of Judaism. So it was written down. First, the Mishnah is written down in Tzipori, a city near the Kinneret, in the very beginning of the 3rd century Common Era, is when it's concluded. But then they write an expanded version of it, called the Gemara, which usually we quote the Babylonian version of that, which was concluded in the 6th century Common Era in what is today Iraq. However, there was another version of that expansion that was written in Israel itself, concluded a little bit earlier, usually called the Jerusalem Talmud. And there they bring us yet another idea, number 12. Some taught it must be soft. That in fact, when you make your haroset, you don't want it to be too thick. Why? To commemorate the blood. The blood they're talking about is the blood of the first plague. The first plague, the plague of blood, right? When the water turns to blood. So you would want this to actually be like blood. Now, yeah. Okay. Now, that creates certain problems. Well, it creates a range of problems. Let me take them one by one. The first problem that you have is, we just said you're supposed to make it thick to be like the clay. Sorry?
Blood is red.
We're going to get to that also. The appearance issue is going to matter too. But how do I manage this if I want it to be thick? So take a look at source number 13, where we get rabbinic commentary in the 12th, 13th century saying, when we eat it, we dilute it with wine and vinegar. In other words, you make it thick, you bring it out to the table, and then you pour wine or vinegar into it, and that will make it more liquid. Now, I should note that actually creates a problem of Jewish law for us this year, because the first Seder is on Shabbat. And that's actually not something one would do on Shabbat. Making a long story short, what's recommended is actually to pour wine or vinegar in a bowl and then put the haroset into that. You're kind of doing things backwards. Putting the wine or the vinegar into the bowl and then adding the haroset. I don't want to confuse things any more than I have to. But I did note that for you in number 15 from Rabbi Avram Gambiner. So, one issue is you need thick. So therefore we're going to start thick, and then we'll thin it out. But then, we have a problem. Well, the main problem is, I don't know of anybody who does this. Right? Generally speaking, what people do is they make thick haroset. Now, that was one of the things that everybody said when I asked what haroset is supposed to be like. People said it's supposed to be thick. Any guess as to why people aren't making thin haroset? So here's an interesting question, actually. Isn't it going to fall off the Korech sandwich? So a couple of notes regarding the Korech sandwich, just worth knowing. The first is that what we're doing is wrong. I'm sorry. Unless you happen to have a true Yemenite among you, matzah originally was not what we use. What we use is largely an artifact of the age of mechanical rollers and machines, which enabled people to make it really thin. If you go back a few centuries, what they were doing was making thick matzah, more like a lava. As a matter of fact, the Code of Jewish Law says the maximum thickness for matzah is what's called a tefach, which is roughly 3.6 inches. Like that. because you can't make it so thick, because if you make it really thick, then there can be flour in it that doesn't get baked through, and that can become chametz. So you don't want to be too thick. But it didn't have to be paper thin either. The advantage when thin is that you know for sure no flour is going to go unbaked. So it's good in that sense. But when you get to the Koreg sandwich and you sit there asking yourself, not only are they expecting me to take matzah and use lettuce with it and have it not crumble everywhere, but in the times of the temple they're putting a lamb on it, right? How'd they get lamb on there? The answer is it's a lapa. It's a lot easier. They sell those at one of the 100 lapa restaurants we have here in Toronto. That's something, that's number one to know about the sandwich, in which case this becomes a lot easier, doesn't it? The second is that when you're dealing with koreg, with the sandwich, you don't necessarily put the harozet on it as much as dip some of the maror into it, and some people will even shake it off after that. There isn't the need to actually have it sit on the sandwich. That's in terms of that piece of it. But in terms of the liquid, I suspect, and this is just a suspicion of mine, and I can't base it on a particular text, but I suspect that the reason why we stopped, and people largely stopped, making it liquid, had to do with a completely different problem. And that's the blood libel. Historically, there was a preference at the Seder to use red wine. However, there were times in Jewish history when people said, you know, that's a really bad idea. Because there would be allegations from the Christian community that Jews were actually using the blood of Christian children, which is, I mean, ludicrous from our perspective, and deadly. And so they said, you know, better to use white wine. And it could be that that also influenced people when it came to the charoset and say, you know, let's not add red wine. I get the idea of making it look like the blood, but, you know, some things are better off commemorated, you know, in your head rather than in practice, because it was literally dangerous. So it could be that that's one reason why it became less popular to do so. But I'm going to include it in the recipe because it is in the text. Is to use, because of the desire for it to commemorate the blood of that first plague, therefore, people would add wine, and that would give you the color. But some would add vinegar, and maybe that's also for this reason. You avoid the issue of the blood. And there are more customs. There are two other customs. One custom is to say, let's make it sharp tasting, to evoke the experience of slavery. So I brought you that in number 16, to use acidic things. And then, you have the last one. And someone mentioned walnuts before. Take a look at number 17, please. In which we are told about a responsum of the Gaonim. You're talking now 8th, 9th century. Make charoset of fruits that are compared to the Jews in Song of Songs. Meaning Song of Songs compares us to a whole bunch of fruits and nuts. No jokes. So one line, between the apple I awakened you, so use apple. Another one describes us, our beauty actually, as being like a split pomegranate. Like when you open up the pomegranate. So some people would use pomegranate in it. The fig has sweetened. We were compared to figs. I said I would climb the date palm. Eggos, which is usually translated as walnut, so there, and they quote a verse from Song of Songs where the nut garden is evoked. And then almonds, because almond in Hebrew is shaked, and to employ shkida is to be diligent. One who is shaked is somebody who is diligent, and God was diligent about taking us out of Egypt. So therefore almonds are used. So you end up from number 17 with all sorts of fruits and nuts as part of this. So now we have the idea of having a sharp taste, like the slavery. And then you have fruits and nuts as well. I hope I haven't complicated your shopping list too much. But I did give you a table at the bottom of the sheet. You see that table at the bottom of the second side? So here I give you the summary of all the ingredients and what they are meant to commemorate. So you can see we have certain items that are there for taste. We have certain items that are there for texture. And we have a couple of ingredients that are used specifically. And this is what we use in order to have charoset. There is a secret ingredient that I will note, and that is something I mentioned earlier. According to the view that tapuach may actually refer to the etrog, right? I mentioned that before. So some people actually will include esrog in their charoset. Maybe someone's using lemon juice that I mentioned before. That's sort of similar. Okay. Sorry? Right, so you'd have to save it. You have to like freeze it after Sukkot. In order to get... Hey, I don't know where you get an etrog this time of year. Good luck. On the other hand, if you go at the end of Sukkot, you can probably get a good deal on it. Buy it at the end of Sukkot, freeze it, and you have it now for your charoset. Okay. So... what I did here this morning may have been a little bit, yeah, it wasn't the usual in terms of what we discussed, and I hope that that I didn't confuse things too much for people, just a little bit. But I'm also going to give you a short idea for your Seder, because I think that that people should have, you know, nice things to say at the Seder as well. So we'll take a couple of minutes post-Charoset to express something else.